Welcome to the deep dive. So today we're wrestling with, it's a central challenge, maybe the central challenge of cognitive science.
News. It's this massive gap, isn't it, between the, you know, the molecular level, the genes, and the complex things we actually do, observable behavior.
Exactly. How do you bridge that? It's an enormous scaling problem.
It really is. It's the ultimate challenge if you're trying to model this stuff. You're looking at information flowing from, like, tiny chemical reactions.
Yeah.
Picoseconds. Yeah, and ending up as behaviors that take whole seconds, all happening in the same structure. It's kind of wild.
Absolutely. So our deep dive today is all about mapping that complexity. We're using sources on phenomics and biomodeling to try and get a handle on it.
Right.
We want to give you a clearer picture of, first, the brain's physical architecture, because it's pretty out there.
It sets the stage for everything else.
Totally. Then we'll look at how we analyze dysfunction. Now, things like RDOC, and finally, get into how network activity actually underpins, well, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Attention, emotions, even how you learn.
But first, yeah, we have to grapple with the sheer scale, the physical constraints. Researchers studying the brain, they're dealing with just immense ranges, time and space.
The numbers are staggering.
Ugh.
When you actually look at them, you see why trying to model the whole brain at once is, well, basically impossible right now.
It really is. Spatially, you're talking about roughly 10 orders of magnitude difference. Think about it.
Yeah.
You go from 10 meters, this molecule size, all the way up to maybe a meter for the whole nervous system. Central, autonomic, peripheral.
Wow. 10 orders of magnitude. So if a molecule was like a single grain of sand,
the whole system would be huge, kilometers across, and time is just as crazy.
Right. The temporal scale.
Also, 10 maybe more orders of magnitude. Those molecules, they're doing their thing in 10, 12 seconds, picoseconds.
Unimaginably fast.
Synapses are a bit slower, maybe microseconds. But the big brain systems, the ones coordinating actual thoughts or actions, they operate around the 1 second mark or even slower.
So, okay, you have things happening in trillionths of a second and other things taking seconds. Where does all that speed go? How does the system bridge that temporal gap?
That's the core question. And yeah, it means you need totally different mass, different models for the chemistry versus the network stuff.
Exists.
And the way it's organized is key. The brain's network, it's fundamentally hierarchical and modular.
Okay, so layers and specialized parts.
Exactly. Big picture, it's quite ordered. We know roughly this bit does vision, that bit does movement. But zoom right in to the small scale.
Then it's chaos.
Pretty much. Random-looking connections, noisy activity, it's complex.
And getting signals around relies on two different kinds of communication lines.
That's a good way to put it. You've got specific projections. Think of them like dedicated wires connecting specific region A to specific region B.
Like circuits.
Right. But then you also have diffuse projections. This is more like broadcasting, hormones, neurotransmitters washing over large areas.
So not point-to-point, but area-to-area.
Exactly. Bathing whole territories in chemicals that tune their overall activity levels up or down.
Okay, got it. So let's trace that complexity back. If the network is the result, where does it start?
At the genetic level, right.
Right back to basics. DNA, discovered 53, that holds the initial instructions.
The blueprint.
Yeah. Genes code for proteins.
Mm-hmm.
Those proteins then assemble into everything else, the receptors, the ion channels, the synapse structures, the neuron body.
So the genes basically dictate the neuron's fundamental properties, how it fires, how it connects.
They provide the substrate, the raw materials, and basic design. And the scale of information there is, well, let's throw out some numbers.
Hit me.
Okay, so you have about 50 trillion cells in your body. If you took the DNA from all of them, stretched it end to end.
How long?
100 billion kilometers.
No way.
Yeah, it's about 666 times the distance from here to the sun.
That's actually unbelievable. All packed inside us.
We're built from just mountains of code, and the activity within each neuron is frantic. Ion channels, you mentioned them?
Mm-hmm. A single channel can pass 100 million ions every second.
100 million per second.
And one neuron might have 10,000 of those channels. The local electrical and chemical storm is immense.
Okay, that level of complexity, it must mean there's tons of variation, right? No two brains are identical.
Absolutely guaranteed. I think about protein variations. There's one gene, DSCAM. It alone can potentially produce 38,000 different protein variants.
Wow. So even identical twins won't have identical neural wiring.
Not down to the finest detail, no way. Which leads us to, how do we even measure the connection between those genes and the behaviors we see?
Right, that's heritability, isn't it?
Yep. Heritability, in simple terms, is just the percentage of the total variation you see in a trait, the phenotype that you can attribute to genetic differences in the population.
So, like, how much of the difference in height between people is down to their genes?
Exactly. And the actual calculation, VP equals VA plus VD and so on, it gets complex. It tries to account for different kinds of genetic effects, additive, dominance, interactions, plus the environment, of course.
Wait, that genic interaction bit. What does that really mean for behavior?
It means genes don't just add up simply. Gene A's effect might change depending on gene B. It's interactive, nonlinear, makes it super hard to pin down the gene for any complex behavior.
Because there rarely is just one.
Almost never for complex traits. But here's the crucial thing for you listening. Genes provide the potential, the building blocks, the substrate for cognition.
But they don't dictate the outcome on their own.
Precisely. The environment plays a huge role. It's what turns genes on or off using things called transcription factors. Experience shapes which genetic potentials actually get built into the working network.
Okay, so if you have that much complexity from genes in the environment constantly shaping things, it makes sense that our old ways of labeling problems like depression or ADHD, based just on symptoms, maybe weren't enough.
They really weren't. That's where this idea of phenomics comes in, studying all the observable characteristics. And yeah, around 2008, researchers were saying loud and clear that the old diagnostic boxes, quoting the source here, they may not capture fundamental underlying mechanisms of dysfunction.
They were missing the network level.
Pretty much. Which led the NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health, to develop the RDOC framework, Research Domain Criteria.
All right, RDOC. What's the big idea there? How is it different?
Instead of starting with symptom clusters, RDOC tries to organize research around fundamental dimensions of functioning, mapped onto underlying biobehavioral systems. It puts the network level kind of in the middle.
Bridging the gap.
Connecting the molecular stuff up to the mental level, often using computational models. It defines these big brain systems. I think there are six now.
Six major domains, yeah, like negative valence, positive valence, cognitive systems.
Right. Attention, working memory. They added sensory motor systems recently, too. The focus shifts to how these large-scale systems are regulated or dysregulated.
So instead of just saying anxiety disorder, you might look at dysregulation within the negative valence system.
Something like that. It's a shift in perspective, focusing on underlying mechanisms rather than just the surface symptoms.
But we still need words like memory or attention, right? We can't just talk about network nodes firing.
Oh, absolutely. These psychological constructs are essential. They're how we group these continuous brain processes into meaningful patterns we can actually talk about and study. They link the physical brain to mental experience. That's why things like the Cognitive Atlas Project are important, trying to map out these concepts.
Makes sense. Now, the RDOC approach sounds like a big step, but the source material also points out some limitations, doesn't it?
It does. A key critique is that even this network-focused approach can still downplay or ignore other really critical factors.
Like what?
Like the physical environment someone lives in, the impact of epigenetics, how experience modifies gene expression over time, and the whole process of development from infancy onwards. These aren't always central in the RDOC matrix itself.
Right. Development seems crucial. Which brings us nicely to the brain in motion. If experience shapes the network, how do we actually see that? How do we study these connections?
That's where the connectome comes in. The connectome is basically the wiring diagram of the brain.
The map of all the connections.
Exactly. And we map it using tools like MRI, especially diffusion MRI, for the structural connections, the white matter tracks.
The physical cables.
Right. And fMRI, functional MRI, to see functional connectivity, which brain regions tend to fire together in sync when you're doing something, or even just resting.
And analyzing that data involves graph theory, nodes, and edges.
Yeah, basically. You define your nodes, brain regions, and measure how strongly they're connected or correlated. Then you can analyze the network's properties, like how clustered it is, or how efficiently information can travel through it.
And when you look at it this way, certain networks really pop out as being important for, like, higher level thinking.
Definitely. The frontoparietal network, FPN, is a big one. It seems to act like a flexible controller, shifting its connections to manage whatever task you're currently doing, crucial for cognitive control.
So the hierarchy and modules we talked about earlier, they show up in function too.
They do. You have subnetworks that handle more basic but vital functions, things like keeping you aroused and awake, managing attention, processing positive or negative feelings.
And you can actually link this network activity to specific cognitive abilities.
Yes, that's the goal. For example, researchers can map functional connectivity patterns and find correlations with scores on things like a verbal intelligence quotient test, the VIQ. It suggests a physical basis in the network for that cognitive ability.
Okay, what about when you're not concentrating? When your mind wanders?
Then you see activity in the default mode network, the DBN. It's actually less active when you're focused on an external task.
But more active when?
When you're doing internal stuff. Thinking about yourself, reflecting on social situations, remembering the past, imagining the future, daydreaming, basically.
So zoning out isn't just empty time. Your brain is doing important internal work.
Exactly. It highlights how much is going on internally, stuff that purely symptom-based views might miss.
And conversely, if you disrupt that normal, organized network activity, say, with psychedelics.
Right. The sources mention substances like psilocybin or LSD. What happens then is that the usual modular structure seems to break down temporarily.
Everything talks to everything.
Kind of, yeah. Brain regions that don't normally communicate directly show increased synchrony. You get this massively interconnected, less hierarchical state, a temporary loss of the usual organization.
Wow. Okay, so can we link this network stuff back to something practical, like learning styles?
Well, their model's trying to do just that. Dutch's work from 2020 is mentioned, suggesting connectome activity patterns might relate to different conceptual levels people operate on.
What are the levels?
They propose three. S, the sensory level input from vision, touch, etc., in occipital and somatosensory areas. M, the motor level physical action output. And C, the central associative level.
C is for abstract thinking.
Exactly. Abstract concepts, planning, reasoning happening more in parietal, temporal, prefrontal areas. The idea is that your predominant patterns of activity and connection strengths between these levels might influence how you learn best.
So if someone struggles with abstract thought,
the model might predict weaker connections within that C level, or maybe weaker connections between C areas, like poor synchronization between frontal and parietal lobes, which we know are important for that flexible control network.
And it connects to development, too. You mentioned autism spectrum disorder earlier.
Yeah, the idea there is that sometimes you might see an over-reliance on, say, S-to-S connections, very strong sensory processing loops, perhaps at the expense of developing those more abstract C-to-C connections as robustly. It's a way of thinking about how network dynamics might underlie different cognitive profiles.
It all comes back to the network connections and how they fire together.
Which brings us towards the end point. We have to remember the brain isn't static. It matures. We see that physically, right? The amount of gray matter actually decreases in some areas during development as connections are pruned and refined.
Streamlining the network.
Making it more efficient. And this underlines why the early environment is so critical. Sensorimotor activity, exploring the world as an infant, that literally organizes the brain's networks during sensitive periods. Getting that right is key for reaching full potential.
So it leads to this distinction the sources make, genetic versus neural determinism.
Oh, right. It's an important one. Genetic determinism sets the broad strokes, the basic anatomy, the types of neurons, the overall plan.
But it doesn't wire everything up specifically.
No. Neural determinism is the idea that the specific connections, the ones you actually use to think and feel, those are formed through your interactions with the environment, your personal experiences, your culture.
So ultimately, we can only think thoughts that our current neuronal activity allows.
That's the core idea. Your thoughts emerge from the patterns of firing across your unique network, which has been shaped by your life.
Okay, so let's land this. If our thoughts depend entirely on this neuronal activity, shaped by genes and experience, what's the ultimate source? Is it the structure or something else?
The sources point towards neurodynamics. It's not just the static wiring diagram, the connectome.
It's the activity on the wires.
Exactly. It's the constantly changing dynamic state of electrical and chemical activity flowing across that structure. The connectome is the stage, but neurodynamics is the actual play unfolding moment by moment. That's proposed as the true source of our thoughts, feelings, and understanding.
Wow. Okay, so to recap that whole journey for everyone listening. We went from molecules firing in picoseconds.
Up through the immense complexity of genes and proteins building neurons.
So these vast hierarchical modular networks mapped by the connectome.
Shaped by environment and experience, studied through frameworks like RDOC.
And realize that the physical structure just sets the stage. It's the dynamic, ever-changing activity on that stage, the neurodynamics, that actually is our mental life.
And the source material gives us that really potent metaphor to capture it all. The mind is the shadow of neurodynamics.
The mind is the shadow of neurodynamics.
Okay.
So if neurodynamics is the real engine of thought, and the source material also suggests that we often confabulate, basically making up stories to explain our own actions after the fact. Here's the final thought we want to leave you with. If our conscious awareness, our sense of why we do things, is maybe just that shadow, just a story told after the neurodynamics have already happened, what does that mean for how we think about our choices, our sense of free will or responsibility?
Yeah.
What would it look like to explain ourselves purely in terms of the dynamical state of our brains without the neat, confabulated narrative? Something to think about. We definitely encourage you to explore this idea of neurodynamics further.